Estancia La Jolla Hotel and Spa, which is just down the street from the Salk Institute. And today there's the Glenn Center for Aging Research Symposium on Metabolism and Aging. And early this morning, Tomasz Horvat from Yale gave a talk on hunger promoting hypothalamic neurons regulate lifespan. Do you want to tell me what that was about?
Yeah, so our interest is to try to understand how chronic disorders emerge, what drive their propagation, how that then leads to death. And we have this very simple assertion, and that is that where time plays a role, in this case in chronic disorders, that emerge in the fifth, sixth, seventh generation of our lives. What really time is for a cell? How time gets translated into cellular dysfunction, tissue dysfunction, and death? And it's a very simple basic assertion, and that's how you use fuels, how your cells utilize nutrients from the environment, and how that utilization, burning of the fuels, using it for building cell structures and tissues, lead to slow but sure impairment of the cell and then tissue, yeah. And how eventually genetics and epigenetics intervene and makes a difference in the outcome.
Yeah, does this translate into the usual stuff about that people like to write about in the New York Times and tell you how you should live your life? Do you have any practical advice for people about what they should do based on
no,
your research?
No, so it's a very interesting thing. I think it's very simple, and the information I think has been there for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
To prolong life, you need to moderate your intake, specifically intake in regard of food. Eat little, and then you're gonna live longer.
Yeah.
It's very simple. So. If your goal is to live the longest within your boundaries, you have individual boundaries, of course, what might be your maximum lifespan, if you want to make sure that you do the most for yourself, you should follow a calorie restriction. So if the goal is to maximize lifespan, yes. But if you then look at what other components of life you might want to pursue, I think you need to balance out really what is your personal goal. Is maximum lifespan is your goal? Pursuit of other realm in life are your goal, and then you may have to switch to a different approach.
Okay, but take something like caloric restriction.
Yes.
Okay, so it's all over the place. I mean, we hear pro, con, arguments for and against and so on. But what's your sense of the field at this point?
So I do believe that if you caloric restrict, so you are in a constant hunger state in principle. That is benefiting your body. All parts of your body is going to benefit from that. With one exception, you won't be able to build and grow cells and tissues, and which may have major impacts on certain brain functions. One of the most important organ in that regard, I think, from a perspective of human being, is the cortex, the prefrontal cortex specifically of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the part of your brain that gives you the ability to make decisions, proper decisions regarding your life and the lives of others. And the prefrontal cortex is really not functioning the best under these conditions. Other parts of your body will, so you benefit.
Right.
But in decision making, it's really not the best way to go.
You're a professor of comparative medicine, neurobiology and obstetrics,
yeah.
Gynecology, reproductive sciences, section of comparative medicine, you're going across a huge area here. I mean, how do you augment this?
I mean, so I went to veterinary school, so I'm a trained veterinarian. And
wow.
But my overall interest is really the whole body, how our body functions, how it survives, and how it deals with disorders and stresses and negative experiences in life. So when you try to understand the whole body, it's very difficult to focus on a single entity within the body, a single cell, a single mechanism. So I think, while we may be superficial in many aspects of our pursuits, in order for you to better understand the whole organism, I think you need to sacrifice on unfortunately, I have to say, you have to sacrifice on depth, at least in your own research sometimes.
Yeah.
And that's why you have these various aspects of our works, because when you look at the whole body, of course, your entire body hinges on all the different tissues that, you have. Yeah. You cannot say that a human being is really a human being because of its brain size or brain, and there is much more to our existence than simply arguing that this is the brain that makes us humans.
So, go back to cortex. Go back to prefrontal cortex and the driving engine of our thinking, cognition, and so on and so forth. What's the best evidence that you have? What do you know that would best have the engine running at its optimum capacity?
I actually would like to step back a little bit to put in perspective what the central nervous system is all about, in my view, and I think I'm not alone with that view. So you do not need a central nervous system to be a successful complex organism. The longest lived species in our Earth are plants that don't have a central nervous system. And these are complex organisms. So you start to see the brain or central nervous system come about when you need to move rapidly in your environment to secure resources for survival, food specifically. Mm-hmm. So as you look at the evolution of the brain and brain structure and the primitive components of the brain that first came about, then became more complex and more complex, at the end of the day, they all support two fundamental functions. One is to survive from one day to the other, feeding, and the other one is to make sure that your gametes are propagated, so reproduction. So these are the two fundamental functions that your brain came about to support. And no matter how sophisticated it became in our hands sitting here discussing things in a technically advanced thing, you need to go back and understand that even the prefrontal cortex and cortex is there to support those two basic functions, feeding and reproduction. Of course, oxygen as well, without which we couldn't metabolize. So then I think when you make that reasoning, then you need to better understand the relationship, even now, today, the relationship between, the prefrontal cortex and the rest of the body, because they came about to support the rest of the body. So there must be a major impact how your body then influences those structures as well and their function. So what might be the best way to go back to your original question, to support the function of the prefrontal cortex? I think you can really have a better take on that if you start to be analyzing how the system evolved and how they relate to these peripheral functions.
Yeah. So I mean, my argument would have been that you need to, which I think is yours, that you need to keep your bioenergetic bank balance in the black all the time. Because if you're running out of resources, you're in a really bad situation. So in terms of aging research, if that's a fundamental given, what's the best advice that we can get from how to do that?
Well, I think the fundamental thing is you need to maintain hunger. If you lose hunger, and I literally mean hunger, then you lose your ability to continue in life, and you start to be diminishing yourself. Very simple. I mean, you think I'm talking about philosophically, but not. So the mechanisms that support aspects of calorie restriction that now we understand support health cannot occur without the propagation of actually literal hunger. So in the absence of you feeling hungry, no matter how you might calories restrict yourself, you won't have a beneficial effect on your body. This is our belief based on the research that we are doing. Yeah. So the advice, the simple advice I would have is that find a way to maintain hunger, literal hunger in your life, and then you're going to propagate better your ability to survive.
It sounds like a giant philosophical.
But it's not. I mean, on one hand, it is. On one hand, it is.
Be hungry.
But literally, I'm saying that. We say that. So that's why we argue that when you come with these medications for obesity or diabetes that would suppress your appetite, actually, you're going to kill yourself. You may become lean and you become beautiful, but you're going to die. So you have to make a decision. If how you want to fulfill your life, dying beautiful or living with your body and making sure that you get the best out of your opportunity.
Yeah. As we were walking over here, you were talking about your grandfather?
Yes.
Who was 99
years old.
And did everything in moderation.
He did everything in moderation.
Is there a lesson there?
Well, it would be very interesting to talk to him about it. Unfortunately, I did speak with him a couple of times, and some of the issues we discussed, I don't think you want to put on the roles here. But definitely, if you have the trait to be able to do things in moderation, but that has, basically, you need to have the trait, and that usually involves every aspect of your life. So it's very difficult to have a trait in which you have only no interest in food, but you have interest in other things. So in general, if you do everything in moderation, you benefit, your lifespan will benefit from that.
Do you think that there might be some genetic predisposition in
people? Definitely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I believe, for example, my grandfather had a genetic predisposition to not to be able to, because he didn't have to focus on moderation. He had the trade, and by default, he was doing everything in moderation.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was not an acquired behavior.
So think back, if you would, and go back quite a while. Why did you end up in this line of work? I mean, don't say, medical school and so on. Think about where did the science come into your life? So, parents, teachers, book?
It's a good question. So I'm a failed veterinarian. I went to vet school because my father was a veterinarian, my grandfather was a veterinarian. But early on, even in high school, what really, to be very honest with you, what really drove me in this direction was the book from Watson about the double helix, when he described it. I was like 15 when I read it, and it was, for me, so stimulating. The sort of intellectual struggle and approach that they took on life, that was really, for me, a very important
stimulation. Where were you at this point?
I was back in Hungary. I was in high school, and I just knew that I wanted to do something with my brain that would not be a routine approach.
Yeah. So Jim Watson.
Yes. I mean, whether it was him or just the book, just the overall...
The story, the whole notion of
To pursue something that is unknown for me was the real thing that you need to go after something that you don't know.
What do you tell... I ask people this question all the time. There was a book written some time ago by Sir Peter Medawar called Advice to a Young Scientist. And I always ask people who... gone through the gamut. How do you advise young scientists these days? What do you tell them to do? What's important for them to know?
I think that at least from my own example, what I can say is to pursue things that others don't pursue.
Yeah.
One of the reasons I think I succeeded in some ways was that I decided to pursue questions that not other people were not doing. So if you pick a subject the five other laboratories are working on, and they're all very good, outstanding people, why should you waste your intellectual capital on something that you know somebody else is going to accomplish anyhow?
Yeah, yeah.
To be the, not it's not about ranking that you are fifth or sixth, but how can you contribute the most to the promotion of scientific knowledge? Mm-hmm. Obviously, to pursue something that nobody else is pursuing. And the other one is not to read too much. The more you read, at least if you read it with a grain of salt, if you know that you need to read everything, with maintaining a doubt about it, and that of course includes my own work, that is very important. If you take published information as fact, unfortunately, as Cervantes put it, is the enemy of truth. Because all those facts that you line up frequently don't really add up to the truth. And then, in fact, what they frequently do is hold you back and prevent you to take avenues that people before didn't take.
Yeah, yeah. So your initial adventure was in veterinary medicine, right?
Yes.
And then when did you think this isn't it?
The first year in the vet school. So I went there because my father was my grandfather. Then I realized I'm afraid of most of the animals. I'm allergic to most of the animals. The only thing I like them is to eat them, you know, for dinner. And then during the course of the vet school, I started to do basic research in an anatomy department. Mm. And I realized that if anything, that's the direction I would like to take.
Yeah. So how did you make the shift, though?
I mean, so I think, but I don't want to say that it was a bad decision on my side, because what it gave me by default, I didn't really like it, but I had to take it. It was back in Hungary in the communist times, is that I learned by default about the whole body. So when you learn about, of course, animal medicine is the same as human medicine, you learn about integrative physiology. And I think that's a very useful thing to have when you do eventually basic research, so that every now and then you can step back and ask yourself to what extent this really relates to the whole versus this is just an intellectual game that I'm playing.
So you got fundamental basic training.
Basic training on integrative physiology of the body, yes.
Yeah. So from there?
From there I came to, when I finished the vet school, they were looking for postdocs at Yale, specifically from Eastern Europe, because they knew that for little money, we do a lot of work, which at that time I didn't know it was a little money. They told me $10,000, oh, it's a huge amount of money. I came over, and of course it wasn't, but the point was that it was a great opportunity for me to learn the craft and start to do research, and I got stuck.
Yeah. Did you ever think about doing anything else than this? I mean, was this other career ever a possibility or?
So the main problem that we had back in Europe, at least in Hungary and many other countries, is that you have to decide about your professional life after high school. So there's no college system. We had to go directly to professional schools. And at the age of 17, 18, you have no idea about what you should be doing. And definitely for me, I was much more interested in humanities than anything else.
Yeah.
But I had to go somewhere. And my brother went to medical school because my mother's side, everybody was a physician. And then I went to vet school. But I would have rather be an art historian than anything else.
What was it like growing up in that part of the world at that time? I mean, because you had all these conflicts going on in terms of different issues,
it's very interesting.
Different political issues.
It's very interesting, and I think that actually speaks also to almost to the situation we're talking about, color restriction and versus not. So actually I think it was a great place to do color restriction, because one of the problem with color restriction and in general what happens with your brain is that the prefrontal cortex, who is the best to make wise decisions.
Yeah.
How you should do this and that, is really impaired during color restriction, by unfortunately, by default. There is this very interesting thing, I'm not sure if you read in New York Times about, in Israel, a parole board, they were testing them, how they make decisions on individuals who come up for parole, and how the decisions on the same exact situation differs if they do the decision making before lunch or after lunch.
Oh.
So after lunch, for the same exact with the same exact parameters, you get a parole. Before lunch, you were sent back to jail. So I think this is one of the best for me, the most simple way to show how decision making is really relating to your metabolic profile. If you are in satiety, when you ate enough to feel full, then the prefrontal cortex works much better. Or not better, it depends what your outcome is, good or bad, if you want the guy to go back to the jail or not. But in principle, your way of making decisions is more balancing the facts unrelated to you than when you make the decision before.
But that's huge.
Gigantic. For many, of course, I mean, in this case, that, but in many other things, it is the way the NIH reviews grants, for example. We go there, we sit down at 8 o'clock in the morning and we start to be reviewing grants. And depending on when the grant comes up, there's a major impact of this metabolic state of the individuals.
So how would you ever come up with a system where you could
optimize,
neutralize the timing? Yeah, I mean, that's amazing.
That's amazing. I think, well, it's a good question. And the question whether you want to do that or not. I mean, overall, what difference does it make on society? Maybe not much, because you equalize out the bad and the good. But I think it's a great question to ask.
Yeah.
And whether you want to optimize it, is it really something you want to accomplish?
So this intersection between science and society stuff that we spend a lot of time talking about on the Science Network, when he came into office, President Obama said that his administration would restore science to its rightful place. Gave no coordinates. We don't know what that is.
I don't know what it means.
Do you know?
No, I have no idea. I'll be very honest with you. I don't know what this means.
What's the rightful place of science?
I don't know. And it's a very interesting question. I think if you look at the different disciplines that science encompasses, in a very superficial way, I think you can sort of make, not necessarily conclusions, but at least assertions regarding the rigor of science. So where, if you look at mathematics, if you look at physics, how science there, what science means there, and what science means in biology, specifically biomedicine, a very different meaning of science.
Yeah,
if you go to economy, an entire different dimension of what science means
right,
there.
Right.
So you can actually line up reasoning to argue that science is not that different from art. And then you start to be slipping, not necessarily because it should be that way, but by default it is emerging in that direction.
Yeah.
Biology is a great example for that. Economy is a great example for that as well. But in biology, you look at, and again, going back to this argument of fact and truth, if you look at in the last 20 years, you pick the most prominent journals, Nature, Cell Science, you look at the publications, you pick any disease you're interested in, and you start to be seeing that 20 years ago, they claimed that they found a fundamental machinery to explain this and that disorder, and that the cure is on the way. Very few situations actually led to cure of diseases. And I think it's because science slowly, but I'm not even sure it was before different, but science is between, in a way, true reasoning versus subjective switch or subjective organization of facts. More like, it's almost like Ikebana. A lot of the biomedicine you do is like putting together a Japanese flower arrangement. You put this there, put that there, and you try to sell it as a explanation for an entity.
While you actually
just put together a nice collection of aesthetically reasonable facts. So honestly, that question is very, for me, it's very difficult to answer.
Yeah.
What is science? And what's
right.
the place?
So. Most of your students, when they're given tasks, that what they probably do is they have an access to a library account at the university.
That's true.
And if they want to get some research, they go and download PDFs of the specific papers that they're talking about. They don't read the front of the book of Nature or Science, mm-hmm. where all the social commentary is. So there's a certain limitation in as you drive through, trying to get through this educational system, you lose some of the sense of how it's positioned within society, right? Okay.
True.
So I like to emphasize the notion of people who think about the history of science as well, the philosophy
yes.
of science. If I gave you a time travel token and said you can bring to this table, your dinner table, wherever, somebody, any period of history, any... Who do you want to ask questions?
It's very simple for me. Leonardo.
Okay.
I mean, it's so simple because that guy represents the kind of person I think, at least I belong to that group, that admires and aspires to be.
Yeah.
To be able to, not only knowledgeable, but be able to transfer ideas from one realm of life to a completely different one,
yeah.
and make a huge impact on that. I think for me, that's definitely the type of person like him
yeah.
is the one that I would like to see that and figure out how he is and how he came about.
All right, let me shift you slightly sideways to Eastern Europe again, to Czechoslovakia. Let's go to Milan Kundera, the unique likeness of being,
yes.
all the books that he wrote. He talked in that book about if you remember this at all, he talked about fortuities. He talked about the fact that if Tomás had not gone to this particular place at this particular time and seen her and she was not serving there, there were about six fortuities that ended up in a whole story there. Mm-hmm. So going back to the thing about how scientists, how their trajectories evolve, and the advice to a young scientist. Do you have the sense also of these fortuities going on in your life?
Definitely.
Yeah.
I think, first of all, I think it's extremely dangerous to start out any of these professional directions with a set idea how you want it to develop.
Yeah.
I think serendipity plays a major role.
Yeah.
And you just need to go where it takes you. I think that's the... And this is what I was saying during my talk, that one of the great things about the award I got from the NIH, this Pioneer Award, and actually Harvard uses very similar, in fact, obviously better because it lasts longer, is that you don't have to, classically in the current scientific environment, you have to have a hypothesis and you have to prove your hypothesis. And then you can go to the next thing. Science doesn't work that way. You do something, there is a result, and you should follow the result instead of trying to go coming back and keep on finding ways to prove your own hypothesis, because proving your own hypothesis, what you slowly develop, is a house of cards that may have nothing to do with the biological problem that you are trying to study. Versus, you do something, there is a result, and then you pursue what that result means and go after that.
Tell me about funding. Specifically, let me throw something at you, which is National Institutes of this, National Institutes of that. Young scientists coming to the field, needing funding. The Howard Hughes funds investigators. It says, you guys are good. I'm gonna put my bet on you. Wellcome has done that as well recently.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There's a sense in which you can worry about that, in the sense that seasoned, well-known, regarded investigators are going to get all the money. How are the young kids going to get something in there? So,
I hear you, and I think your point is well taken. Except that I think as long as this is given to support excellence, unrelated to age, and that's what I would like to just emphasize, that if you don't tie it to age, but you find ways to identify people who pursue excellence and they're excellent in that pursuit, mm-hmm. I have no problem with the system giving the money to individuals that way.
Yeah.
When it becomes relating to previous accomplishments only or where they are in their professional career, I understand and I agree with you. But I think the idea to provide support for people who pursue excellence and they are excellent in that, again, pursuit, I have no problem that you would give the money that way versus, with all due respect, distributing the money to as many investigators as possible to support.
Yeah. Where do you see the whole field? This is a Glenn Center meeting. I mean, Paul Glenn's been funding this stuff for a long time. Goes back a long way on these things. We have lots of stuff on the Science Network about how he got involved in this in the first place. What's your sense at the moment of the state of play in the field of aging research?
I think it went through a wonderful transformation the last 10 years. In a sense that when people started to identify contemporary tools, biological tools, identify molecular mechanisms of aging, the whole field became much more exciting for scientists in general. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, don't misunderstand. I'm just saying that alone made a transformation that you attract outstanding individuals to this field, and I think that's what you want and that's what you are doing and that's what they are doing, and I think it's wonderful, because by default, and if you have excellent individuals pursuing aging research, then you're more likely to learn something useful for society.
Right. So what are you optimistic about? Last question.
I'm optimistic about, every day, and if I wake up and I'm okay and I can move forward, that's all I care about. I think I mean, I don't want to say that there is a great hope that we're going to live 200 years, because there is no reason to live 200 years. I mean, the next generation, I have four children, so I want to give space for them eventually. I think we have a great future in front of us about doing fantastic things in science.
Yeah. All right. Great to talk to you.
No, it was wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you very much.